The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, there's apparently a rather large football tournament coming up. So we're going to look at how some of those soccer types can better control their balls using science.
Even when it's deflated, it's still round. Now what that means is you can get a really, really round ball.
It's well documented how altitude affects human performance, but how will the air in South Africa change how the ball behaves during the World Cup?
If you take a shot at sea level, say it's a straight shot, a shot where you put no spin on it, and then do the same shot at altitude, say the altitude of Johannesburg, about 1,700 metres, then the ball would actually be at least two ball diameters ahead of the ball at sea level.
We celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Human Genome Project.
When you take a gene out of the human body, put it in a test tube, it's patentable. That is the same information, the same four-letter code, in here, out there. How can that become patentable?
What did the future look like 350 years ago?
He's probably referring to just a hyperactive state. You know, these people, they observed them, they could see they were not sleeping. Could they harness that?
Plus, your feedback from our live show. And boldly going, well, nowhere, why six men will be sealed in a box for 520 days in a car park in Moscow.
One of the tests that did leap out, although it didn't really say too much, was what is the effect of, let's say, stress on hormones and then gonadal function?
This is another action-packed edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. In the studio today are the Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample and the Observer science editor Robin McKee. Chaps, are you looking forward to this Socera tournament that we've got coming up?
No, I'm not. Scotland
You're not.
Is sadly absent.
You're not supporting
not
England.
The tournament it should be.
Isn't there some test, like a Tebbit test or something?
Well, who should I be supporting? Yeah. I don't want to go down that road. I really don't.
Normally, Scottish people flock to support England in their droves.
Yes,
when,
we do.
When Scotland sadly don't make any of these major tournaments. Yes, so I can't wait. I've taken the first week off work to go down to the countryside just to watch games and play about in the sea.
Excellent. Well, for the first time in 24 years, altitude is going to have an effect on the football being played in the World Cup. Normally, we know that it affects the physiology of players, but how does it also affect the way the ball moves? To help us answer some of this is Steve Hake. He's head of sports engineering at Sheffield Hallam University and has just written a big piece for New Scientist on exactly this. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
Now, we just mentioned physiology. We'll talk about that in a sec, but what is it about altitude that our football players should be concerned about?
Well, I mean, of course, the key issue is that the air density goes down. So as you go up in altitude, air density goes down. So that affects you physiologically, but also affects the way the ball flies through the air. So as the drag force, which is the force that slows the ball down, that's directly proportional to density. So as the density goes down, the drag force goes down and the ball flies faster.
And this has measurable real effects, does it? Because in your feature, you talk about there's a lot of research going on about how the ball might swing or move around in these different densities of air in different places.
Yeah.
But how much of an effect will it have? I mean, will we notice it?
Well, I think what we might see is some of the goalkeepers noticing it. And if the goalkeepers notice it, then you're going to hear about it a lot. And already the likes of David James has come out and said he doesn't like the ball. So our calculations, we've done some trajectory programs, we've put lift and drag coefficients in and worked out for a variety of shots what would happen. So if you take a shot at sea level, say it's a straight shot, a shot where you put no spin on it, and then do the same shot at altitude, say the altitude of Johannesburg, about 1,700 metres, then the ball would actually be at least two ball diameters ahead of the ball at sea level. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but if you're a goalkeeper and you're adapted to sea level, then the ball's likely to be in the net by the time you get there.
Sounds like just another excuse to me. In penalty shootouts, which I hear England aren't very good at.
Apparently.
Now, talking of the World Cup balls, I actually have one now here with me. This is the South Africa 2010 football. It looks like a normal ball to me with slightly different colours. Now, I'm going to throw this to you, Steve, and then hopefully in the magic of podcasting, people will realise that there's a ball in the studio. So here you go.
Away.
There you go. Tell me what's so special about this ball.
Right, okay, well, here's the ball here. So this ball is actually only got 8 panels. Previous balls have had 32 panels or more. So the way they've managed to get 8 panels is by moulding these panels. So it's a bit more like an Airfix model than a previous football. So previous footballs, there would have been a bit of leather or a bit of plastic, and you'd have sewn them together. The last ball that they had at the last World Cup was actually glued together. So it was flat panels, but glued together. And these are actually moulded panels that are glued together. So what that means is that they've already got some curvature in these different panels. And so each panel, even when it's deflated, it's still round. Now, what that means is you can get a really, really round ball. Previously, you've got so many flat panels stuck together that it's not quite so round.
In terms of the way it flies and the way it moves around, and what have you got?
Right. So what happens if you have a very, very smooth ball, then it doesn't actually fly very well. So if you have a completely smooth ball and if you take one of those supermarket footballs.
Yeah, like the cheap ones you can get.
The cheap ones, yeah. It says shoot on the front. Perhaps we should give them to the England team. And they try and kick those and they don't fly very well because they're very, very smooth. Now, if you roughen them up by putting some seams on it, and with those smooth balls, just stick an elastic band around it is enough and you can bend it like Beckham. If you stick some seams on it or some roughness on it, then that does enough to trip the boundary layer of air flowing over it and cause the drag to drop.
It's more round, so does that make it faster as well? Is it lighter? Is it made of special composite materials that they've been working on?
Well, it's made of a thermoplastic. It's glued together, and the idea is when you sew things together, then of course you get holes between the seams. If you glue them together, then they can be more watertight. So one thing about these balls is they don't absorb very much water. So there's a limit on it, 10% maximum of water absorption.
And is it like, I mean, this is just a personal bugbear of mine, but these new balls... And that from what you've said, it sounds like there's actually some new technology involved, so that it's probably worth having. It's not just like strips every season where you change the colour of a strip to make sure someone can buy it, because that's not a cheap ball. That's about £100 or something, isn't it?
This is a tournament ball, so this will be about £100. You can get replicas of this for about £20 in the shops, yes.
What's the difference?
It's a plastic replica of a plastic ball.
No, the actual replica is the old stitched design, just with the same pattern on it, to be honest.
I see, okay. Ian, you're supposedly a footballer. You know how to kick a ball around. Do you think that Steve could help you with your game, or are you beyond help?
Well, what I was really wondering about, rather than myself, who's strangely left out of the England team, was...
Do you want to have a go with the ball?
I do want to have a go with the ball. I was having a little squeeze about it earlier, actually.
There you go.
It genuinely makes me feel emotional to hold this. Yeah, I want to get out and I want to boot it about, and I want to put jumpers down for goalposts and crack on with it and miss lunch and all that sort of thing and not go back to school. Anyway, the question I had for Steve was... Reading your piece in New Scientist, you talk about basically at low altitudes, you've got higher density of air, so you can do things like you can bend the ball better by putting more spin on it. At higher altitude, you can basically thump it from further out of the box, and you might get the ball will travel faster and truer, perhaps. Can you actually teach the players this, in a classroom and say, okay, get out there and remember that? Or is that just not going to work? You have to just get the boys out there kicking the ball around so they experience the conditions. Can you teach this stuff, or do you have to be there and do it?
Oh, no, I think you've got to be there and do it. You know, you got the likes of, let's go David Beckham. I know he's not playing in this tournament, but David Beckham would be out there and he would just do it by experience. Yeah. You know, apparently he used to hang a tyre in the corner of the goal and aim to get the ball through the hole in the tyre. So, after a certain length of time, he would be acclimatized to the flight of the ball. And I think that's what they're going to have to do. They're going to have to just play with it. And apparently some teams haven't actually had a chance to have a go with this ball.
Here you go, Robin. That's what World Cup football looks like.
Yeah, that's what it really is. Fantastic.
Steve, in South Africa, what's the sort of range of the heights of the stadiums and that these players are going to have to get used to? Because they're going to have to change between them. It's not a case that you can acclimatise to one, then you're stuck there. You're going to have to change.
Yeah, that's right. Well, of course, you've got a couple of venues at sea level. You've got Johannesburg, which is around 1,700 metres with an air density of about 20% less, and then you've got Rustenburg, which I think is about 1400 meters. So I think every team that plays at the World Cup is going to be changing altitude.
All right. Well, I've been told by Andy that the person asking questions has to have the ball. So,
here you go.
Steve, if you give it to me, there you go. I have a ball in my hands, if that means anything to any of you out there. What I'd like to know, though, Steve, is that how much of a difference does this actually make to the individuals? We're talking about elite performers here who can change their game every 2 minutes if they want to. So, overall, how much of an effect does all this have?
Do I have to answer? Right, I've got the ball, so you can make me answer. Right, okay. How much of
it? This is very alien to me.
Professional players are very, very sensitive to changes. I mean, we've done tests where we've given a piece of equipment, and with a piece of equipment, we've hidden all the markings, so they've got no idea what the changes are, but they will tell you, they go, there's something different about this, and they'll allude to what it is. Not always with scientific language, with sporting language. So that's the first thing, that players are very, very sensitive. The other thing is, the good players can adapt pretty quickly as long as they've given that time to adapt. So the players will be affected physiologically. So altitude, they'll have the reduction in oxygen is going to affect the way they perform in terms of heart rate, in terms of breathlessness, and so on. And then, of course, you've got the flexible.
How quickly can they acclimatise to that? Because that seems to me to be a big problem if you can't run as fast.
You haven't got the ball.
Here we go.
Someone says, okay, yes. So now that I have the ball, shall I ask the question again?
Go on.
How quickly can they, how much of an effect does that have, the physiology of this?
Yeah, all right, here you go. Right, got the ball. Well, 3 to 5 days apparently is the recommendation that FIFA give you for acclimatisation at this kind of level, about 1700 metres. Oh, coming back. Okay. Right.
I think you're going to have to sort it. Ian's got a question. I'm going to throw the ball over to him. Here you go.
Steve, one of the issues that seems to come up is that it's really changing from low altitude to high altitude and back again that is does become a significant factor for how players behave and how well they play in these kinds of tournaments. And I wondered if you had any insight as to how it looks for England going through. I mean, are they going to be, you know, playing at high altitude, teams that are already, you know, have their home pitches at high altitudes and stuff like that? I mean, I was going to go through the whole sort of, you know, tournament fixtures and work out how things were looking for us, but I'm hoping you've already done that.
No, I haven't done that. Hang on, give me the ball. Right, no, I haven't done that because I started to do that, and I started to look at the effects for different teams quite way back. And of course, you can start doing trajectory programs for every injured team, and it was just a time sink. I had this article to write, so I concentrated on writing the article. But I think one key thing is that every team is going to be changing altitude. And I think it gets to the quarterfinals, and I think every team at the quarterfinals gets someone at altitude playing someone at sea level.
Okay, well, we'll leave that there. Steve's going to be going through all of this stuff and more at the Royal Institution on Tuesday, the 8th of June. His talk is called Boots and Balls, and we can exclusively reveal, I don't think he's written it yet, but hopefully some of this stuff will be included in it. Of course, you can follow all of the Guardian's World Cup coverage at guardian.co.uk/World Cup.
World Cup, every 4 years it's the World Cup, World Cup.
If you don't pick up a grunt straight in the build-up, then we'll love it when you score a goal.
Ooh, did you see that?
World Cup. It might well end in tears or a headbutt. You can follow all the blogging on your laptop. From Slovenia to Slovakia, from Nigeria to the Cote d'Ivoire.
Cote d'Ivoire.
The Guardian and Observer, packed with World Cup coverage every day.
If you came to see us at the Science Museum last week for our first ever live recording, thank you very much. We had a blast, and hopefully we'll be doing more of it soon. We hope it also worked for you if you were there, and in podcast form if you were listening remotely. There have been lots of great comments on Twitter, Facebook and our blog, just a few to go through. Saint of Wrong loves it that when Football Weekly has its summer hiatus, Science Weekly ups its game with Hawking. Would have loved to come to this event, he says, but the Atlantic Ocean and the Andes got in the way. And also he says, 49 minutes this week, I usually listen in the pool, boy will I be buffed by Tuesday, I know how you feel.
Raging Bull lists his favourite geniuses, and they include Bob Dylan, Buddha and Carl Jung.
Yummy Mummy clarifies that.
Kim Peake is the autistic savant who basically memorised lots and lots of books and facts. He was also a calendar type savant, so you could tell him your birthday and he would say what day it was and something interesting that happened that day.
Terra Tornis points out the collective genius of Wikipedia. The site works better than anything one individually could have come up with, he says. No Good To Me says...
Great show this week. Richard Federer is the evil twin who uses his tennis abilities for nefarious means.
SpacePup84 says...
Wicked event. More live recordings, please. Great to finally see everyone in the flesh.
On Twitter, Josh Innes commented...
I hope Science Weekly destroys that entire recording that I did with them. Between the pretty lady and the mic, I turned into a complete idiot.
Carrie Mowat said...
Stealing work with the applause sign.
Thank you very much.
That was Andy, yeah. Well done, Andy. I Say Woohoo said...
Well done, guys. Next time, get the beers in.
Helen Phillips also emailed us...
She thinks scrapping the Twitter display screen that we had behind the panel is a good idea, as it's extremely distracting and invites people to twat about inane things, such as which members of the panel they do and do not fancy.
If you don't know what all of this means, by the way, go back and listen to last week's cracking show. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, it's at Science Weekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all of the Guardian Science content, follow Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
10 years ago, President Bill Clinton and the UK Prime Minister Tony Blair held a joint press conference to announce that scientists had finished sequencing the 3 billion nucleotide letters of the human genome. Today we're learning the language in which God created life, said President Clinton on the morning of 26th of June 2000.
It will revolutionize the diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of most, if not all, human diseases. In coming years, doctors increasingly will be able to cure diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, diabetes, and cancer.
The soaring rhetoric went on. It's now conceivable, he said, that our children's children will know the term cancer only as a constellation of stars. Well, talking of constellations of stars, last week at the Hay Festival, some of the people who carried out that remarkable Human Genome Project got together to discuss the achievements of its first decade. Here's a snippet of the Guardian and Wellcome Trust science debate, chaired by our very own Robin McKee. On the panel were Nobel laureates John Sulston and Martin Evans, between them the men who pioneered the work on sequencing the human genome and also stem cell research. Also there was former chief executive of the Wellcome Trust Genome Campus, Michael Morgan. First up, you're going to hear from John Sulston, who talked about intellectual property rights, also known as IP.
Underneath, there was a serious conflict in the closing days of the HGP, and that was whether the data was going to be released or not. And in fact, we did release it. The public side managed to hold its own. It released all the data, and that's what makes all the things I'm talking about able to happen. Because it's essential that people are able to compare one genome, one bit of this biological information with another. But we're not finished yet with that business, and that's what I'm mostly involved in now. Not the science, but the growing set of gene patenting. Because although we got the human genome and all other genomes out into the public domain for people to look at, we have not managed to get them out of the clutches of people who patent individual genes, because the EU and the US in particular have concocted a legal fiction that although a gene in our body is a natural product and therefore unable to be patented, as soon as you get it out and put it in a test tube, it's now free to go. Is that an inventive step, taking my gene and putting it in there? I think not, but that's the legal fiction.
I've got to raise this one. I've got to raise the name of Craig Venter. We all know what he did. He created a synthetic genome and put it into a bacteria-like organism and got it to replicate. Was he playing God, John?
Let me now move straight on to what I think is important about this, which is not the accomplishment in itself, although I've given credit to its virtuosity, but the fact that they are trying to get extremely broad patent protection on all this. They are using this moniker of artificial cell, which it isn't, it's an artificial genome in a cell. They're using this moniker to so excite the patent application and hopefully the examiners that they are going to give them rights over all these basic manipulations which are being done all over the place all the time. And they're trying to project this into the future. They're naming things like making new sorts of biofuels, hydrogen, cleaning up oil spills. That was done long ago, but anyway, they're going to do it better, I suppose, and so on and so on. With the idea that if any of this goes through, and most of it will get cut down, that something will stick and they will get revenue from it. This is called gaming the system. And the reason that I am so concerned about the way this IP industry that's growing out of all control is it opens up to this kind of gaming. You get a flashy result, and then you try to get very heavy IP coverage as a result. And this will, if it works, if they get away with it, will seriously lock up biotechnology. It'll put it into private hands. It'll make it non-transparent, because the only people who will be able to afford it are other companies. Whereas where it belongs, this is important, sensitive stuff. In the end, it may involve, if you like to call it playing God, that's to say creating new forms of life, but you don't want to start out the process by having key patents in the hands of a corporation.
Martin? No, well, I've already at the Hay Festival this afternoon pointed out that he's American. And
bad start.
And then gone on to say that Americans are perhaps not as insulted at being called cowboys as some of the others would be. And I think that's exactly what he is. And he's, as John has just explained to you far more eloquently, he's really using his power and his money to try to entrap and to grab basic biology in a way that I don't think should be done. And it's just a different philosophy. The trouble is that there is some degree where the whole of the patent lawyer business is going to also make a lot of money out of him. And I just think it's wrong myself. I do not appreciate it.
I can't let you, you know, not get
well,
your
yes, I mean, I actually am somewhat sanguine about the likelihood of any significant intellectual property being awarded to J. Craig Venter for this exercise. As John has pointed out very eloquently, the technology, there's no new technology. It's the application of present technology. It's a technological feat, but most of, as I understand it, most of the technological bits and pieces are already in the public domain.
Yep.
And therefore, when it comes to be properly examined, it will be rejected. That's my hope. Now, perhaps, and that's partly because I know that Craig, I don't think he's had one successful patent granted, has he? And he's applied for many.
The last voice you heard there was Michael Morgan, of formerly of the Wellcome Trust Genome Campus. Robin, having John Sulston in a battle with Craig Venter is a perfect way to start this discussion, because this is exactly what he did 10 years ago patenting of the original genome. We'll come to the artificial life or whatever it is stuff later. I mean, they didn't really hold back, did they, those gentle Nobel laureates? Take us right back to 2000. What was the decade like up to that? Because the sequencing of the human genome...
you weren't that young, for Christ's sake. You must have been around then. Don't give me what was it like in the war, daddy bit.
Still university. What was the sort of race like? It was a race to sort of sequence the book of life, if you want to call it that, without patenting it. Tell us who the actors were.
Well, yes, I mean, you said it was a race. And Venter is always credited with stimulating the public bid to do it and getting it to go faster. To be fair to the public side of it, most of the stuff that Venter was sequencing was actually stuff that was given to him by the public sector.
On the one side, you had the Wellcome Trust and the National Institutes of Health.
Yes.
Funded by governments, racing to sequence the genome. On the other, Craig Venter.
You had Celera, his company. And you had who would get there first and who would make them, you know, who would make most publicity for themselves. And you've got to say Venter won by a long way. I mean, he's a relentlessly effective self-promoter. He's quite extraordinary in that sense. So good for journalists. Whether it's good for science is a different thing.
In 2000 then, I mean, Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, they've sort of brokered a peace, didn't they? They said, look, why don't you all pull this together? This is for the greater benefit of mankind. And we've heard what Bill Clinton had to say. So 2000, we sort of had the first draft of the genome. The eventual final draft came along a few years later. In the debate, what was the mood about what's been achieved in these first 10 years of genomic science? Because there was lots of promise.
I think there was a slight defensiveness of from the three participants, because indeed there was a lot of promise, and not very much has actually come out of it. We have some very good cancer drugs. We have some ideas about diseases like Crohn's disease, about being able to pinpoint the pathways and then look for drugs to block them. But basically what's going on now is in a huge informatics revolution at places like the Sanger Institute, where a lot of this work is going on. Whereas you're not just sequencing one genome, you're sequencing dozens, if not hundreds, and then you're comparing them to find out, well, these are people who have this pattern tend to have these diseases. And so you're teasing out the genetic roots of very complex diseases in the hope that you will eventually find drugs that will block the pathways. It's interesting that the quote that you had there from Clinton, it's conceivable that our children's children will know the term cancer only as a constellation of stars. Well, I think that the latter bit of it is rather silly, but the first bit is interesting. He says our children's children. It's, you know, at least a couple of generations away. That the human genome was a tool. It wasn't an answer in itself. And the three delegates, who were really superb at Hay, were slightly defensive in making that point.
But I think that it's also fair to say that in the first 10 years that we've known about this stuff, the one thing that they're certain about is that the genome is much more complex than anyone ever thought.
Yes.
I mean, in terms of how you actually pass on heredity, it's not just genes, it's about regulation of the genes. Junk DNA is not necessarily junk at all.
Yes.
I mean, we knew very little. And I think I spoke to John Selston a few weeks ago. He was quite sort of humble about this. He said that we just didn't know.
The first surprise was actually how apparently simple it was. We assumed there was about 100,000 genes in the human genome, and when they produced the first draft, there was only about 26,000, and that suggested it was a lot simpler, and Venter made much of that. But in fact, it's a lot more complex, because it's the way that these 26,000 genes are unravelled and how they're switched on and switched off turns out to be much more complex than we thought, and the genome is not as simple as people had implied.
Ian?
I was just interested in this, the argument over the intellectual property rights over genes and DNA. I mean, Selston and the others called for, you know, expressed concerns about this, you know, how there will be a lack of transparency if it falls into private hands and that it will be at the exclusion of other research. But, you know, you have to think, well, this is where we are with Big Pharma. Big Pharma are completely not transparent, and they file an awful lot of patents and make a pile of money out of it. And I don't see how a more protectionist stance over genetic work is going to be realistic. I mean, I think it's desirable in the early stages so that you can have this kind of academic freedom, but it feels a bit ideological to me.
Protectionist in terms of the genetic data in the first place, or do you mean in terms of how it's used?
I think how it's used. I mean, I think the idea, and this came up in the discussion, that the debate that Robin chaired, was that How realistic is it that someone can patent a gene just because it's been taken out of the body and put in a test tube? I don't know if that's really been tested yet. I think maybe you do have to do something novel with it for your patent to be defensible in court. Now, I think that we do want some openness on this kind of work, as I say, so it's not all locked down by private companies straight away. But I do wonder, you know, how do we argue this special case? Private industry will do what private industry wants to do. They have the money and, you know, it will carry on.
Shouldn't it be argued in exactly the way it is being argued, which is that at every stage that there's going to be a big revolution in this stuff. Someone like Venter comes along with the money and the clout and says, right, I'm going to try and patent it. Try and stop me. And if they do, he backs away and does something else. I mean, this is what he does. You can't deny that he's a showman or he's a cowboy, as Martin Evans said. But he's also a good thing for genetic science. I mean, talking about Venter, they were all pretty scathing about him. Yeah, I mean, John Selston there saying that he's trying to grab bits of basic biology. I mean, his let's say rivalry hasn't dimmed down in the last 10 years, has it?
No, it's extraordinary. It's kept on going. I mean, it's great.
Selston's, he's made it his life's work essentially to make sure this stuff's free and easily available. Do you agree with Ian? You've got to let some of this go into private hands, otherwise you just don't get anywhere.
Well, I mean, we live in a capitalist society, and who else is going to make drugs but other than big businesses? They do need some protection, but I still think that kind of Selston is on the right thing, and the basic information, and the more you get that basic information, the more get it out more quickly, then the better placed we are as society.
How optimistic were the three of them about the next 10 years?
Very optimistic.
And what kinds of things were they saying we're going to see? bear in mind, these are the guys who told us we're going to have cures for everything in 10 years, 10 years ago.
Well, to be fair to them, they said they didn't see it. And they
no, they didn't.
Me
you're
for
right.
Seeing
of
it.
Course you're right.
And yes, it was hyped, and it was largely hyped by the press, I suppose. So I had to stick
it. And come on.
I had to hold my hand up slightly there. But mostly, the breakthroughs, as I said, will be in terms of understanding human variation and this ability to sequence. I mean, it took, 7 years to sequence one human genome between 1993 and 2000. At Sanger Institute now, they do 3 or 4 genomes a day. And that gives you this incredible power to compare them. But then we're comparing, you know, sets of 3 billion base pairs looking for 1 or 2 slight differences in it. And that means a massive amount of computing power. And as I say, if you go to Sanger, its computing base would put the one at the runs the Large Hadron Collider in CERN to shame, really.
This is the introduction of physics and engineering and things to biology, isn't it?
If you want to be a geneticist now and do that kind of work, you need at least 2 degrees in computing and maths before you even get around to thinking about the biology of it.
I just wanted to say something about this idea of personalized genomics and cancer genomics, especially because it's getting a lot of coverage lately. And the idea that you can, it's fascinating if you can track a tumor through its progression and you know exactly how a patient's treatment is affecting their particular tumor. But there is almost an assumption that people have that we have this plethora of different cancer drugs, which we can throw at people. It's not, if you have a test which says a certain cancer drug won't work for you, it doesn't mean that there are a dozen waiting in the wings that will be better for you. It's more like, oh, well, then maybe nothing will, or that, you know, we will have to use this at such an incredibly small dose because your body can't process the products. So I think you need two strands to this. You need the cancer genomics, but you also need the drug development on the, you know, as well, so that you can marry the two together to get any real effect, I think.
Steve, you're an engineer, yep. So genetics might not be exactly what you think about every day, but the genetics of sport has to start entering your world sooner rather than later, doesn't it?
I think it's inevitable, actually. I think what we'll see, I mean, generally, if you or I think of something and we think that'd be a great idea, someone else has thought about it already. So I wouldn't be surprised to find out that someone's using genetics somehow behind the scenes, whether it's artificial drugs or some implants, or I don't know.
What do you think ethically, though? Do you think it's something that's...
I'm a bit nervous, actually. Personally, I'm very nervous about it. I would like to see some rules coming in somewhere from the ruling bodies. Yeah,
moratorium, perhaps, until we know more.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, leave your thoughts on the blog too at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And while you're there, make sure you subscribe to this podcast as well.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
The Royal Society in London is 350 years old this year and is holding an exhibition to celebrate. Ian Sample went along for a preview. Ian, tell us what you saw.
Well, the exhibition has all manner of instruments and manuscripts and portraits and things like Newton's death mask, which I didn't even know existed, on display. And they chart the history of science and the Royal Society for the past 350 years. But there was one item which I really loved that I focused in on, which was this a huge book that included some notes that were written down by Robert Boyle, one of the founding fathers of the Royal Society in the 1660s. So he wrote down essentially a wish list, a kind of what should science be looking at, you know, in the future? What are the problems that we should be cracking with science? And it was this handwritten 24 notes, essentially just simple sentences with no explanation of what the context was, but it was a stunning insight into what was important to them at the time. And I spoke to Keith Moore, the Royal Society's librarian, who took me through this list.
Well, I like the ones to do with being able to live and work underwater. I go scuba diving a bit, so I quite like the idea that Robert Boyle was thinking about these things in the 1660s.
That doesn't sound a very sort of scientific endeavour, or was it? I mean, what would be driving a wish like that?
Well, these were very practical people. I mean, they did have an interest in the mechanical sciences as well as the more esoteric stuff. So they would make things. You know, Newton would make his telescope. Robert Hooke would make a carriage on legs rather than wheels. They experimented in that kind of area as well as the more traditional science as we know it.
It's interesting, you look at the top of the list, the first two items will probably be on any list like this today. You have, starts off with the prolongation of life, and secondly, the recovery of youth, or at least some of the marks of it as new teeth, hair coloured as in youth. I mean, I suppose you could say we've achieved some of those things.
We have. Oh, I haven't had my Botox done today, but of course people do try and prolong youth that way. More seriously, though, medical advances have meant that we do live longer and healthier in the West.
Some of the other things on the list, we've got potent drugs to alter or exalt imagination, waking memory and other functions, and appease pain, procure innocent sleep, harmless dreams, etc. They had a lot of faith in pharmaceuticals and probably weren't too far off in predicting what they might achieve.
I think you're right. I mean, most of the things on that list, in fact, all of the things on that list, we have some kind of pharmaceutical helper to make it happen.
He lists great strength and agility of body exemplified by that of frantic, epileptic and hysterical persons. Presumably what he's saying there is hysterical people can be hard to restrain. Can we tap into this enormous strength that maybe is somewhere in all of us?
Well, that's right. And he's probably referring to just a hyperactive state. You know, these people, they observed them. They could see they were not sleeping. Could they harness that? They were looking at the natural world and into people and seeing what is there that we can use? What can we study and help to improve the human race by studying?
There is a great tradition looking through this list of observation. You look at things in the natural world and say, can we turn that to our advantage? I mean, this one in particular being an example, I think, and also another one on the list where he's talking about whether you can tap into the idea that madmen, as it refers to here, don't need much sleep.
Well, that's right. And there are, I mean, scientists still do this, of course. There's a field of biomimetics where people copy things in nature and try to adapt it. I guess the famous one is the old shark skin swimsuit, isn't it? So people are still doing this, and it's a useful activity.
One of my favourites on here actually is an incredibly simple one. A ship not to be sunk. Are we there yet?
Well, no, we keep trying, don't we? The Titanic's probably not a very good example of that kind of thing. But he also says ships are capable of moving without sails. So he's looking towards a different form of motive power in vessels.
Keith, what do you think finally would be on this list if it were drawn up today?
Oh, goodness me. Well, the Royal Society this year has been running a series of discussion meetings to look at areas that would be of great interest to people in the next 350 years. What would I choose? Well, I'd quite like to find alien life out there somewhere. That would be a good one. I think we should be out there looking.
There's a brilliant picture gallery to go with this story at guardian.co.uk/science. And also, while you're there, you can join our Facebook group. We're called The Guardian's Science Weekly Podcast. Let's have a look now at some of the other science stories around this week.
News Jack.
Clinical trials of a vaccine designed to protect healthy women against breast cancer could begin within the next 2 years. The jab is still under development, but its effectiveness has impressed doctors who tested it on animals prone to the disease. If the vaccine works on human patients, researchers say GPs could offer it to women before they reach their mid-40s, when the risk of breast cancer starts to rise steeply.
A £500,000 public dialogue over GM food could be abandoned after a second member of the steering group overseeing it resigned. The government's independent food watchdog, the Food Standards Agency, had been commissioned by the Labour government to gauge the public mood on growing and eating the controversial foods. Professor Brian Wynne became the second member to resign in just 8 days. He said the planned consultation was biased in favour of the technology and was little more than propaganda for the industry.
Do lessons need to be learned from the methadone ban? The drug, also known as Meow Meow, was made illegal on the basis of limited evidence and media hysteria that followed the deaths of two people. It's now been revealed that there's no evidence that either of the two had taken methadone. It appears they took some other sedative drug, probably methadone, which is highly dangerous in combination with high levels of alcohol.
And six men have been sealed inside a mock-up spaceship in Moscow, in a car park. They'll spend the next 520 days in there testing how well humans cope with the stress of a return trip to Mars. They've already had a year of strenuous astronaut training. To keep the would-be astronauts on their toes, agency officials will simulate equipment failures and medical emergencies.
And there's only one story really that is worth talking about in all of that. I mean, they're all wonderful and important, but this 520 days sitting inside a box, I mean, what are they going to do? What are they looking for from these astronauts?
Well, they're going to be monitored by video cameras, by wireless devices. They're going to do tests on each other. They're going to swab each other for bacteria. They're going to be taking different kinds of food supplements, doing different exercise regimes, sitting in occasionally blue-tinged light. All of this stuff is going to be looking at how can you keep these people, I was going to say poor people, but they volunteered, how can you keep these people psychologically intact for what would be the shortest run to Mars, 520 days there and back, with 30 days on the surface. And the living quarters they have, it's hermetically sealed. They're sitting in there, six blokes, and it's essentially three buses, bus-sized capsules linked together. You've got like a living quarters with a really sparse room. It's worse than my student room when I was at college. You've got a little gym and then a little medic bay, and that's it for a year and a half.
Like, sounds like the worst Big Brother episode ever.
Bear in mind that all of the people have been selected because they're basically scientists and engineers. So they're not going to be models.
Careful what you say.
All I mean is that you have, you know, this is a tight demographic of people. They all have very similar interests. There won't be someone you can talk to, I suspect, for a brilliant rundown on the arts and literature.
The other thing, of course, to say is astronauts are usually chosen because they're very, very calm people. And Neil Armstrong is possibly the most boring man in the world, but one of my heroes. So, you know, the conversation is not going to flow, is it, really, in there?
Well, they've been given all kinds of tests to make sure that they are, at the moment at least, mentally very strong, that there is you know, little risk of them becoming so desperately lonely or just so bored of the same old faces that they flip. And, you know, there's only so much testing you can do with, you know, questionnaires and face-to-face things with psychologists. And let's bear in mind, I have to mention that only in 1999-2000, the Russians did a test which was nowhere near as long as this, which went disastrously wrong. I mean, two of the Russian guys ended up in a fist fight after getting drunk, and there was blood spattered on the walls of the capsule. One of them, actually the captain, forced himself on the female Canadian woman who was there. That went down like a lead balloon. The whole thing descended into chaos, which is probably what, you know, might happen on the way to Mars if you really didn't pick your crew properly.
I won't forgive myself if I don't ask the question I've got written down here, but it's not even a question, it's just one word. It just says gonads. Does that mean?
It's amazing what you can pick out of.
I didn't write it down. This is written by someone else.
I did tweet that one of the many things that these guys will be testing along the way. There's something like, I think I counted 14 different scientific protocols that they have to adhere to. And a lot of this involves self-testing, testing each other to make sure that, you know, just to follow how things are going, looking at metabolites and looking at, you know, how they're coping physiologically. And one of the tests that did leap out, although it didn't really say too much, was what is the effect of, let's say, stress on hormones and then gonadal function? So I'm sure that is a big question in space medicine. I don't really know where it leads, but it's you know, it's a detail and it's a fact. I had to mention it.
I'm going to let that hang there. For everything you want to know on all these stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science or environmentguardian.co.uk. That's it for this week's show. Thanks to Robin McKee and Ian Sample, and also this week's guest, Steve Hake. His talk at the Royal Institution is on Tuesday, the 8th of June. Steve, we didn't ask you who's going to win the World Cup. Who's going to win? You've probably done more analysis than others.
Yeah, well, I think I'm collecting my answers here. I got the sweepstake at work. I got Italy, so I want Italy to do well. I think with the altitude factor, I'm going to go for a South American team, and I'm probably going to go for Brazil.
You're sticking your neck out there.
There you go. Okay. Well, sticking with the RI, on June the 14th, Guardian columnist Fred Pearce will be talking about his new book, The Climate Files. This is the definitive account of the email leak from one of the top climate science centres in the world. In his book, Fred contends that despite all the media frenzy, the fact is that just about everything you've heard and read about the University of East Anglia emails is wrong. They're not the smoking gun for some great global warming hoax, and they don't reveal a sinister conspiracy by scientists to fabricate global warming data. That's on June the 14th at the Royal Institution. Go to ri.ac.uk for that and for Steve Hake's talk. Next week, we'll be joined by theoretical physicist Chris Llewellyn-Smith. He was the Director General of CERN a while ago and also is an expert in research on nuclear fusion. Don't forget to add your voice to our discussions at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. By the way, we're asking people there what their favourite science-related blogs are, so do add your thoughts if you can. The podcast was produced today by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. One thing, this quote from Bill Clinton, is there a clip of him saying this? There must be somewhere. But if not, can we just get someone to read it out, like, in an American accent? I could do mine in an American accent. We're gaining ever more art and complexity. The beauty, the wonder of God's most divine and sacred gift.
You sound like Sylvester Stallone.
With this profound knowledge, humankind is on the verge of gaining immense new power to heal.
This man is a friend of yours.
It's Elvis.
Yeah.
Elvis is alive and working in the garden.
Let's not do that, shall we?
You do a Mark Lawson on you. What kind of accent were you aiming for?
That's Bill Clinton.
A touch of Irish in there.
It's Bill Clinton. Fucking.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.